All rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Johnson, Judge Larson, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated, everyone. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is December 20, 2023. We have six cases on our calendar this morning. The first one is A230806, Piper versus Carlson. Counsel, you're familiar with our proceedings. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd ask that you state your name and identify your client before you begin speaking. These matters are being recorded. That is the only recording that's permitted. And with that, we're ready to proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Courtney Sibo Savica, and I represent the appellant, Dawn Marie Piper, in this matter. Your honors, this is a case involving the custody of inseminated eggs, embryos, that were created through the in vitro fertilization process by the appellant, Ms. Piper, and the respondent, Mr. Carlson. The district court decided in Mr. Carlson's favor, but this is the rare case that this court is hearing where the court should be left with the definite and firm conviction that an injustice has occurred for the following reasons. So the district court employed the Rooks factors, which is a balancing test, and it's created by the Supreme Court in Colorado, the Rooks Court. And that balancing test has five factors that are to be considered, and also a number of factors that are to not be considered. The first one involves the constitutional rights of the parties. So the first factor is actually the intended use of the embryos, but of course it involves the constitutional rights of the parties. Appellant's constitutional rights are to procreate, and the respondent's constitutional rights are to avoid becoming a parent when he does not want to be one. Ms. Piper's constitutional rights at all times have been absolute. At all times, she has wanted to create the embryos, she has gone through the IVF process, and she has then created the embryos with Mr. Carlson's sperm.
Counsel?
Yes.
Could I interrupt you for a question,
please?
Since it sounds like you're getting into the factors, actually two questions. So
yes.
First, do you agree that the district court applied the correct test, or at least the test it was asked to apply and no one objected to?
Yes, correct, Your Honor.
And then at the start of your argument, you said this court should be able to conclude that an injustice occurred. I assume you're referring to some iteration of the abuse of discretion standard.
Correct.
So
correct.
You agree that the standard review is abuse of discretion?
Yes.
Okay. And I think the line you're referencing is actually, we need to be certain that a mistake occurred, not an injustice. I mean, there's a difference.
Correct.
Okay, so the standard is actually whether or not there was a mistake.
Correct.
Okay.
But in this case, I think we could certainly say that both have occurred.
Okay, but is injustice...
Correct.
A standard
yes.
We use to assess the district court's reasoning or decision?
No, it is not. I would agree. Mistake, yes. And in fact, as set forth in the briefs, there have been a number of mistakes in applying
okay.
the Rooks factors to the facts in this situation. And going through those factors, then the first factor isn't the intended use of the embryos. And that's when the district court then did review the constitutional rights of the parties and found that the parties had equal footing in terms of their respective constitutional rights, which is not true. They do not have equal footing. Ms. Piper's absolute right to procreate outweighs Mr. Carlson's conditional exercise of his right to avoid procreation. And when I say conditional...
What's the legal authority for that proposition?
So, well, first of all... We are terming this a conditional right based upon the facts. So there is no legal authority except for because this is a balancing test in the district court and now this court are required to determine the respective rights of the parties. Ms. Piper's did outweigh Mr. Carlson's because she has a right to procreate if she has no other means. So that is all part of the balancing test. As far as there being a case for me to cite that says an absolute right outweighs a conditional one, I have no case. But
what do you mean by a conditional right?
So it's a conditional right because Mr. Carlson did exercise his right to procreate when he agreed to inseminate the eggs, and then now is retroactively asking for that right to...
But when he did that, didn't he sign a document, didn't both parties sign a document saying that we need both parties' consent at each step of the procedure?
No. There was no document that said that there needed to be a consent for... is the court referring to insemination versus implantation?
Yes.
No, there's no document that states that, to my knowledge, on the record. So,
Ms. Ebel, before you go forward, I have a question about, I'm wondering why, I understand the Rooks test, even if we apply the Rooks test, I'm wondering why we should be concerned about the party's constitutional rights.
Before you answer that question, I'm sorry, the clock is not going.
Oh, boy.
So we're going to...
I didn't even notice. Okay.
Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Judge Johnson. Continues.
That's okay. Thank you. I'm wondering why we should consider and give way to the party's constitutional rights. It seems to me that the constitutional rights that have been referenced have to do with the rights of an individual vis-a-vis the government. You know, and if there's a government restriction, a prohibition on, say, using birth control, prohibition on abortion, and so on.
Exactly.
That's where that case law comes into play. What we have here is two individuals, private individuals, who have made agreement with each other. Why should we be so concerned? And we don't have any governmental imposition of a restriction or limitations, it seems, on the parties in this case. So why should we be so concerned about the parties' constitutional rights?
Well, I mean, because the court has been asked to step in at this point due to the contract that was signed by the parties, and that contract said that the parties were to, if they could not come up with an agreement as to the disposition of the embryos, the parties were to get a court order. So because the court has been asked to step in and weigh these factors to determine whether or not that Ms. Piper can actually have these embryos implanted in her is a constitutional right. It is her right to procreate. And that is something the courts usually
But there's no government restriction on her... I mean, let's say if both parties agreed, there's no government action or no government law that would prevent her from doing what she wants to do, right?
Certainly, there's no law. Yes, and a statute would have been helpful in this case. But I think when the courts are being asked to determine the disposition of embryos, certainly the constitutional rights of the parties are to be considered. The Rooks court did that, and many of the other courts that are cited in the case that then use the Rooks factors.
Why couldn't we just substitute something like the party's interests or their desires or wishes or their, deservedness? It seems like that's a little bit part of the calculus, but I guess, I don't know if anybody has a right to do anything, but it seems like they have the desires of what they want to do, and they have some form of consent form between them. It seems like that's all we have.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and I think maybe it's just to put it into a bigger perspective of trying to understand why there is a disagreement in the first place. Ms. Piper wants to have the embryos implanted so that she can have children. More children. Mr. Carlson is opposed to that. He does not want to have additional children, or at least not with Ms. Piper, not with these embryos. So I think it's just, it's in the broader context. I don't know that it necessarily really matters at this point. I agree with the court. I don't know if deservedness would be a word I would be okay with using, but the other rights, interests, desires, I can understand where the court's coming from in that regard.
I just want to go back to the question I had earlier. I'm looking at a reference in the record to consent forms that were signed by both parties, and one in particular says, if we elect to use frozen embryos, we understand that each subsequent cycle will require the completion of the frozen embryo transfer consent authorization and release by both patient and partner, if applicable, to thaw and transfer the frozen pre-embryos or embryos. So I guess my question is, I'm having a hard time understanding why any agreement constitutional right was conditional if what the parties agreed to was that although sperm was donated before the embryos were thawed and transferred, there would need to be another signed consent from both parties.
Because most IVF processes do not involve frozen embryos. Having gone through four myself, I can
doesn't
say.
Doesn't this case involve?
It does.
Okay, so why doesn't that language say that?
Because she could have, what she wanted to do was have them implanted immediately. So they didn't need to be frozen. So the frozen aspect didn't need to be taken into consideration here.
Was that argued before the district court?
There was very little argued before the district court. There was simply testimony. I would have to look at the proposed findings of fact.
I thought we're here on a case involving frozen embryos.
We are. The embryos are frozen.
Even though we have this language in the consent form that both parties signed, it's not applicable because your client would have done something else before the embryos were frozen?
Correct. The embryos can be transferred to a uterus when they are fresh.
But that's not the fact situation we
because
have here.
Because Mr. Carlson didn't allow it to happen.
I'm unclear.
I'm very unclear.
Is the case moot? Is that what?
No. The embryos are frozen. So we are here because the embryos are frozen. They could have been transferred during a fresh cycle.
Did she ask to do that?
Yes.
And did respondent refuse?
Yes.
And then isn't your remedy at that point to go get an injunction?
Well, she did the declare. Well, at that point, then they were frozen because they couldn't have been transferred immediately. Because embryos cannot survive. I mean, you cannot grow an embryo in a petri dish indefinitely. So you have a very, very short window within which a uterus can receive an embryo. And that window,
So because they couldn't agree, the embryos were then frozen.
That is my understanding, yes. I was not at the district court level. I was not involved in any of that. But they are frozen now, yes, yes. The second Rooks factor is the ability to have children by any other means. This is where the district court completely disregarded the expert testimony, which was unrefuted, of Dr. April Batchelor. She did testify that Ms. Piper was 2 years past a point when she could have her own children with her own eggs. A woman's ovarian reserve decreases dramatically at a certain age, and I'm sure the court saw the graph.
I agree with you that the district court was not detailed in its analysis of the expert testimony in this case, but my read of the record, and you'll have to excuse, I understand this is a very sensitive matter for both of the parties, and I don't want by the nature of our questions for people to receive this as a disrespectful question, but I want, we need to get the answers to our legal questions. The record does indicate that she does retain fertility. She's not infertile. So when the district court says that it's not impossible for her to procreate naturally, there is some support for that in the record. Would you disagree with that?
I would disagree with that.
Okay, why?
Because Dr. Batchelor said it would have been miraculous for her to have been able to use her own eggs after the age of 44.
But she also said that she was not infertile, or that your client was not infertile, right?
Because, yes, she did, okay. Because the embryos could be implanted into her uterus. So you can't be infertile if you can carry a baby to term, or if you can become pregnant. That was the only reason she was not diagnosed as infertile. Although I would venture to guess that her records probably have a diagnosis of infertility because she was going through IVF and because of her age. But no, because she could carry the babies to term or could become pregnant, she was not infertile. So she does not have to be infertile either. She does not have to reach that standard of absolutely being unable to have any children through any other means. That's not what the case law says.
So assuming that's correct and that the district court made clearly erroneous factual findings there, the conclusion that the district court reached with respect to that factor was to favor that factor in your client's favor.
Slightly, yes.
Yes. But the other factors, And when I read the conclusion that the district court reached, ultimate conclusion, was that that factor did not, or that the other factors were so heavily weighted by the district court that its determination in the Rooks balancing was that was in favor of the respondent in this case.
Yes. And
so why isn't that, if the district court's factual finding is clearly erroneous, why isn't that a harmless error, given that the factor was weighed in your client's favor?
Well, because when you look at the other factors, I mean, first of all, it was so against the weight of the evidence. Dr. Batchelor specifically said she was 2 years past being able to have her own children with her own embryos. Ovarian reserves in women, as set forth in that graph that is part of the district court record, are practically nil at the age of 44. This testimony was unrefuted. There was absolutely no dispute over Dr. Batchelor's testimony. The tens of thousands of women she has treated, she's never had one over the age of 44 use her own eggs to be able to have children. So that's why it shouldn't have just been slightly weighted in Ms. Piper's favor. It should have been fully weighted in her favor.
But why does that make a difference given the ultimate conclusions that the district court made? I mean, factoring in that it was that factor was weighed in her favor, whether slightly or strongly. I mean, the Rooks test does not weight factor two greater than any other factor.
No. But it is a balancing test. It's the aggregate, right? So if it's gonna cause the scale to drop in one person's favor, then every little bit counts. The third factor is of the Rooks case is the original intent of the IVF. Now this is the one where it gets just a little bit messy from the district court's perspective, because the district court brought in the term coercion, which I do not feel is an appropriate. First of all, it's not supported by the evidence, but also is not appropriate in the context of this third factor. And the reason is because the party's original intent in doing IVF was to create embryos or to have biological children. Mr. Carlson said that if their relationship had been in a good place, he would have allowed Ms. Piper to implant the embryos. Part of the on the record, he says he begrudgingly went along with the process. He did things one step at a time. He wanted to appease Ms. Piper, which indicates that he was not communicating his true intentions to Ms. Piper. She was relying upon his actions, his affirmative actions, in inseminating these eggs. I really want to rush through these because I really want to get to the fourth and fifth factors. The fourth factor is the hardship. And this is the one that's truly very, very concerning. There is absolutely no mention of Ms. Piper's hardship in having gone through the IVF process. There's no mention of the emotional toll it took on her, the physical toll, the toll to her health, the toll to her finances. The district court completely disregarded her experience and instead had a lot of value judgments about whether or not a baby should have been brought into this relationship, which is clearly what the court is not supposed to do. The court is not supposed to have a value judgment about whether or not a relationship is healthy enough to have a baby brought into it. And then the
Counsel,
fifth...
Counsel, your time has expired,
okay.
So if you just want to...
Okay, thank
quickly,
you, Your Honor. So,
oh,
yep.
Thank you very much. We'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Council will reset the clock for you.
Thank you. May it please the court. Council, my name is Dennis Grand, and I represent Jacob Carlson, the respondent in this case. Mr. Carlson, respectfully asked the court to affirm Judge McGill's decision. The issue in this case is, did the court err in its decision not to release the fertilized eggs to her? The answer is no for three reasons: textual, contextual, and consequences. The text is the Constitution, the right of privacy. The context is the threat and ultimatums and pressure that she exercised over him. And it's not just once or twice, but it's multiple times, and there are numerous emails and texts in the record that demonstrate that. And then the consequences, and the consequences, it's the consequences to the person who does not want to have procreation occur. And in this case, the consequences to him and to the and to the born children and to a child and to the unborn child create such psychological obstacles because two parents are who fathered two kids are raising them in different homes in different ways, recognizing different statuses.
Counsel, I appreciate the framing of the issues. I want to go back to the Rooks factors and the manner in which the district court analyzed those factors. Some of the things that the district court referenced as reasons why the embryos should not be, the control of the embryo should not be granted to Ms. Piper include the fact that she could have another child through other means, and the Rooks court expressly rejected that consideration as a valid consideration. Do you want to address that? Why wasn't that error by the district court or an abuse of discretion?
The testimony was she could have a child by other means by she was still fertile. I asked that question.
Let me be more direct in my question. The district court says she could adopt or foster a child.
Yes.
And the Rooks court says that whether a person who wants to have a biological child can possibly adopt or foster a child is not a relevant consideration under the Rooks test.
Under the Rooks test, but there are approximately eight other decisions across the country addressing that issue, and they don't all say that adoption or surrogacy or fostering is something that should not be considered.
So explain to me why it should be considered, because it seems to me that the crux of this case is that there is a desire to have a biological child by the appellant. And having a child via surrogacy or adoption or fostering does not satisfy the desire of the appellant in this particular case. So why is it a relevant consideration in determining the ownership of the embryos, for lack of a better term? Why is adoption or alternate means of having a non-biological child a relevant consideration?
It's a relevant consideration if the provider of the sperm doesn't want to have a child. And that's the textual part of the case. The Constitution, you know, the general rule is that no person can be forced into a familial relationship they don't want. The courts have upheld principles in a breach of contract to marry, birth control, abortion protections, and divorce statutes. And so the reason why adoption or fostering is a relevant alternative is because the father or the person who provided the sperm does not want to procreate.
The district court also considered the fact that Ms. Piper has a biological child already. And the Rooks court indicated that that was not a proper factor to consider in determining the, again, lack of a better term, ownership of the embryo at issue. Was it an error by the district court to consider that factor? And if not, why not?
First of all, Rooks is not precedent. So
I'm aware. We don't have any precedent.
Yes. In other cases have said that the fact that you have had a child is something that can be considered. It's the plethora of all of the facts that surround the situation.
And why is that a valid consideration in determining the ownership again, lack of a better term, of this embryo? Why should it be a valid consideration? I mean, we have to fashion some sort of a test here, and I just want to know what sort of a test, what the test should look like.
Well, the test should consider all other options for bringing up a child, for raising a child. And that, of course, is one of the most significant factors. One of the factors is the burden on the person who does not want to have the child. And the court went through, and the brief went through, and the decision went through all of the permutations and combinations of bizarre psychological situations where the biological child asks father, why can't the IVF kid, why can't he come with on visitation? Why is he different? Why am I different than him? Is he as good as me? Am I better than him? Same way with it when the biological child asks father those same questions and mother those same questions. And then the IVF child asks mother those same questions and father those same questions. And you're just asking for an enormous psychological case study, for lack of a better term, if this is permitted. So you have two kids, so you have two parents raising two kids in different homes with different labels and treating them differently, and that is a burden that weighs heavily against fostering procreation or permitting procreation. The only case holding the court found the rights of each were equal. Her right to procreate was no greater than his right not to procreate. The court rejected the concept of conditional consent. And in fact, it was known from the very beginning that you had to sign off, each party had to sign off at every step of the way. So I was going to say, donating sperm is not the end of the line. He has to agree at every step of the way, including the last step, namely consenting to implantation. The only case holding that a woman's right to the embryo is superior than the man's was Sinfransky. In the Illinois case from 2018. And first of all, that was a contract case decided on contract basis. It was not a balancing test. And the operative language in that contract was that the woman had the right to the embryos under any and all circumstances. And that language is not anywhere in this case. It's not in any contract. It's not in any. There's no testimony that he said you can have the embryos under any and all circumstances. And so this is totally different than the Sinfransky case. Anyway, the second factor is context. Context sets up the backdrop for each party's rights under the Constitution. The court loosely refers to Rooks and balancing the equities, but that's not the law in Minnesota. Also, these parties are not married, and the embryo is not marital property, so the court can't award it to one party or the other on marital grounds. The parties had one assisted child in August of 19. So this is not like the cases where the woman in the plaintiff in other cases is childless and has no other biological children. Another important fact is that the parties ended their tumultuous, and that's what the court called it, tumultuous relationship in 2020 after experiencing significant conflict and arguments about nearly everything, including the parenting time with the living child. There were extended periods of time where Mr. Carlson was denied any parenting time with the child. 76 days is the exact number. After their breakup.
Mr. Grand?
Yes, sir.
Could I interrupt? And a minute ago, you said that the embryos are not marital property, cannot be awarded in a dissolution case. I think that's what you said?
Yes.
And is there authority for that?
Well, I've analyzed every case, all the cases where the parties were married, and on that basis, they don't call the embryo marital property, but on the other hand.
So a few years ago, this court issued a non-precedential opinion in Rucker v. Rucker. I'm not sure if it's in the briefs or not, but the district court in that case awarded frozen embryos as marital property, and that award, so to speak, was reviewed on appeal. It was I think reversed for contractual reasons. But I'm just wondering if you've read Rucker, if you think that it's inconsistent with the law in some other respect.
I read Rucker and disregarded it because it's a contract case, and this is a balancing test.
Right, contract case arising from an award in a dissolution decree, I believe. But.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thanks.
Participation in the IVF process does not, in and of itself, manifest an intent to produce a biological child under any circumstances that may come about. Now, and the quote for that is two recent cases, Fabos and Cass. And so the mere donating a sperm, and that took 10 months after they broke up because Piper went full speed ahead after they broke up and issued numerous ultimatums and threats to restrict his parenting time with their biological child if he didn't participate in IVF. It took him 10 months before he donated his sperm. Now, eventually he refused to permit implanting because their relationship was not in a healthy place. And in the record, that appears four times, and one time it appears a stable or healthy place. And Piper was not allowing Carlson parenting time with the biological child. In all of the documents that he signed, there was no unclear and unequivocal statement that he would participate through the termination or through the end of the IVF process. Now, the court findings are, and the court made findings along those lines. All of the court's findings are supported by documentary evidence or testimony of the parties. The documentary evidence about the pressure and the intimidation and the ultimatums and the threats, I mean, I stopped counting at 20 in the texts back and forth between the parties. All of the court's findings are supported by, looks like I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Counsel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Yes. Thank you. Counsel left off and then also started where these threats, these ultimatums that are part of the record. I don't think that those text messages can be read outside of the context of the desperation of someone who was at the very end of her fertility, who understood that she was at the very end of her fertility, had communicated with Mr. Carlson on a number of occasions that she wanted to have a biological sibling to her daughter, Mr. Carlson had acquiesced, had agreed, had tried naturally with her at this time, and then had agreed to go through the IVF process. So,
Counsel, one of the things that I asked Mr. Grand about that I think we ran out of time, and I was intending to ask you about in your initial argument, was the considerations of whether a biological child already exists and also whether adoption or surrogacy is a possibility. And I know that those factors or those considerations were rejected by the Rooks Court. They have been considered in other contexts. And as we are fashioning a test to deal with this novel situation that's before us, I'm interested to hear why it is that you believe that those factors should be outside of our consideration.
Right, absolutely they should be. I think the Rooks Court gave a very good explanation for why they should not be included. We do not want courts making value judgments about who should have biological children and who should have adopted children. Adoption is a wonderful, beautiful process. It's entirely distinct from having your own biological children. So it's a values judgment. And again, as is the value judgment of saying you can only have 4 children, or you've had 16, that's too many. It is not the court's place to put its values upon these parties. And it's not the court's place to say, boy, these parties didn't have a great relationship. Well, they shouldn't have another biological child. Those are value statements that have no place in the courts.
Ms. Sebo-Savica, excuse me.
It's okay.
Isn't it so that, all 6 of the factors, in a very general, big-picture sense, don't they almost expect or require a district court to make some value judgments? I'm wondering how we draw the line between permissible value judgments and impermissible value judgments.
Well, and I think that that's what the Rooks Court has done really well. That's why its factors have been adopted all over the country, because they've done a really nice job of threading that needle. They've done a nice job of saying the intended use of IVF based upon testimony, based upon the record. It's not my value statement of whether or not it was right for you to go through IVF or that it was a good idea for you to go through IVF. The hardships to the parties, again, based upon the record, based upon the testimony of the parties. So I think the Rooks Court has done an excellent job of that, of not improperly making impermissible value judgments. I would also like to point out that this statement that if we're in a good place in our relationship, then it's appropriate for us to have another child. That was based entirely upon Mr. Carlson's definition of what a good relationship was. That was based entirely on his wanting to retain control over a situation that he had already provided genetic material for, and then retroactively wanting to say, nope, stop, I want veto power at any point in the process so that I can say I don't want to have a biological child with you, even though I already agreed to it, even though I already did the affirmative actions to help us have one at IVF. He could have gone to court and indeed did go to court to obtain custody of his daughter. That was something he should have done all along. That never should have been something that should have ever been a factor in these discussions. And I would also like to point out 2 last things. The first is there is a text message in the record that has a graph of an ovarian reserve based upon age. And Ms. Piper says, do you understand? And Mr. Carlson's response is, give me equal, pretty easy. Equal in this case meant equal parenting time, which is what he had referenced over and over again in his text messages. And then lastly, I would like to leave the court with a request to please review the Safransky case in detail, because the Safransky case has very similar facts and some extremely helpful analysis with regard to a lot of the questions we dealt with today. Thank you so much.
Judge Frisch, can I ask one more question?
Yes, of course. Yeah. Judge Johnson has an additional question.
Yes, Your Honor.
The district court identified sort of 3 different approaches that prevail in other states. And I guess I'm wondering if there's a 4th approach. I'm wondering if any courts anywhere have basically applied the law of gifts. Or in other words, is there a situation or a scenario, if there's no contract, where simply a man hands over sperm to a woman and it's deemed a gift without any kind of restrictions or need for balancing tests. I'm not saying that those are the facts of this case because there was a consent form, but I'm wondering if there's case law. You've surely read more cases on this than we have. I'm wondering if you've seen any such case law.
I have not. I have not in terms of gifts, but I would point the court's attention to the fact that in the event of death, the embryos were to be given to Ms. Piper. So while it's not a gift, it is a testamentary disposition, or at least an intention to have a testamentary disposition, which I find intriguing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Appreciate your arguments and your submissions. The matter is taken under advisement. We'll issue an opinion within the statutory time period.